Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Seems we've got the microphone working this time. That was Catatonia and Road Rage. And before that, Sex Pistols and Holiday in the Sun, The Darkness, I Believe in a Thing Called Love, oh yes. And before that, The Stranglers, No More Heroes. Or at least if there are, they're lurking somewhere out of sight, a lot of them. I'm sure they're still out there, the heroes. We're just waiting. Should have a very interesting show for you tonight. I will be playing another tune whilst I go and round up Brian Forster, who last spoke with us in, I think it was April 2012. I think we had a really fascinating conversation with him about all manner of things, mainly about elongated skulls, because one of the things that fascinates Dr. Rock, really, is some of the ancient history that we've got that appears to have gone missing. We seem to be constantly forgetting things about what happened in the past. We seem to be constantly receiving a bit of misinformation about what was going on and stuff. And so I like to go looking at people who are actually living on the ground and getting evidence of strange things that are not really in line with orthodoxy. And Brian Forster is definitely one of those men, living out as he is now in Peru, and helping to run a museum called the Paracas History Museum, which is full of interesting things, especially these very, very unusual elongated skulls. And later on in the show, probably from about 10 o'clock, we'll be talking with Hugh Newman, who's written a book called Earth Grids, The Secret Patterns of Gaia's Sacred Sites. But I know he knows a lot about other things as well. He's been spending a bit of time with Brian Forster. Bit of buzz feedback. Ah, yes, well, there probably is going to be a bit of that. When I play the next tune, I will check my settings. There is a little bit, there's a limit to how much I can do about that. This weekend, however, we will be installing a new broadcaster on a replacement laptop, and I'm seriously hoping that the business with the buzz will go away. So, Brian Forster coming up, Hugh Newman a bit later, talking about megalithic sites and earth grids and the like. Should be a searching for ancient history of planet Earth styly show tonight. Not too serious, but hopefully plenty of interesting info. So I will go check in my sound levels and stuff, and play one more tune, get Brian Forster, and then we'll be back with you for a bit of live chat on the Skype. And hopefully this will be the last time you'll all have to put up with the bloody buzz. So here's a good old one, David Bowie, Oh You Pretty Thing. Seems to be pretty suitable for talking about elongated skulls. Depends what you like, I suppose. And I think I've managed to make contact with Brian Forster. I think we've got some fairly strange and industrial noises in the background. Thanks very, very much for joining us again. I've really been looking forward to talking to you again, and I've been catching up on the many videos. I can't believe that it's 2012 when we spoke last, which is nearly 4 years ago now.
No, that is amazing.
That is a very interesting noise. It sounds a bit like we've got somebody with a skill saw or something working away in the background.
Well, actually, we do. They're doing tile setting on the third floor, and I can't stop them.
Oh, well, there you go. That's what we get for phoning before the end of work in the afternoon, I guess. Hopefully they won't be doing that. Oh, that's good. Well, at least we identified the noise. I know exactly what it is now, and it's nothing to do with us, thankfully.
Okay, great.
So, being as it's been such a long time, and we've migrated from being TNS radio all those years ago to being People's Internet Radio, perhaps you could give us a quick introduction to yourself and what you're doing in Peru, and talk to us just a little bit about the Paracas History Museum and what you've got in there.
Certainly. I've had a lifelong interest in indigenous people, and so I started out living in Canada by carving totem poles and canoes and things in the native tradition. Then eventually I moved to Hawaii and was involved with a large voyaging canoe project there, and traveled through Polynesia. And then for some reason my attention was drawn to Peru, which was about 10 years ago. And about 5 years ago I stumbled into a small museum in Paracas on the coast south of Lima, and saw an elongated skull in this museum, developed a friendship with the director, Senior Juan, and over the course of 5 years, we've increased the collection of elongated skulls to about 45.
Very good. And that's it's good having those on display, isn't it? Because when we last spoke, we realised that actually there were at one stage quite a lot of elongated skulls on display around the world, especially in places like Malta. But they all seem to have been stashed away.
I know. I don't know if it's a conspiracy that's going on or whatever. But it's also the case in Peru. There are there are hundreds of these elongated skulls in Peru, but most of them are stored away in the museum collections behind locked doors. Only authorized personnel can see them. So that's why we decided with the Paracas Museum that we will open the cases and take the skulls out for people to photograph and video, and also anyone who's medically related at all is allowed to examine them to see the differences between a normal human skull and what we have in the museum.
And are you having any luck in, I see from one or two of your videos, you have managed to get a few doctors and other qualified people to comment on some of these things. Are you attracting more such people to your museum?
Yes, we've had more than 20 so far. Doctors, dentists, nurses, anatomy experts, etc., look at them. And they are... Most of the skulls, of course, are the result of cranial deformation, but there are some which none of these doctors can properly explain.
Yeah, how many of those have you got in there?
I would say 5 or 6 of the 45 have characteristics which are very strange, and 1 or 2 especially.
And what is it that's specific? Because let's first of all define what we mean when we talk about cradle boarding and the ones that have been kind of deformed through that sort of technique. Let's describe what they are first, if we can, to distinguish them from the other more peculiar ones.
Certainly. Well, cranial deformation, which is the altering of a baby's skull, more or less from birth, and is a process that requires 2 to 3 years, has happened on all of the inhabited continents. There are even examples in England I know of, as well as Germany, and basically all over the place. And that was a ceremonial practice in order to make the ruling elite physically look different from the general population. But in the case of Peru, and especially around Paracas and also in the highlands near Cusco, there are examples of skulls which don't seem to have been artificially deformed. They appear to be natural in character.
So they are actually the shape of the skulls that appear to have been born that way. And they're very large. They're very large, aren't they?
They are. There's a great variation, of course. The most intriguing ones are there's one that appears to be 2 years old, and its skull is the size of its torso. And there's another one which is in a museum in La Paz, Bolivia, which is the same thing. It's not simply large. It's huge relative to the size of the body. And you can't, that explained away by altering the shape of the skull because the overall sizes are enormous.
Yes, I've just cut and pasted the link to your video of that, the strange skeleton with the really huge skull, which is almost as big as the body. And also the body underneath that one's got 10 ribs, hasn't it?
Yeah, there are so many characteristics about that skeleton, that it really confounds the medical professionals who look. They of course use their medical expertise, their knowledge of anatomy to initially try to explain away these characteristics. But at the end, they're all dumbfounded and say, I don't understand what it is that I'm looking at.
Which is really great, because I know that when you were last speaking, you were finding it very difficult to attract such people. And obviously, presumably, each one that comes along and has a look then goes and speaks to their friends and stuff. I know that particular one, I saw a photo with the man with it out of its case, so it was actually allowing people to check that that the head was part of the body, and they really are the torso and the head are the same size, aren't they?
Well, the great thing about this is that skeleton, thanks to anthropologist Teo Paredes of Cusco, a British film crew made a documentary that aired in September. It's available on the internet, and Teo was able to take the skeleton to his family's very large medical facility, and they ran it through a whole series of tests, including x-rays, CT scans, DNA testing, etc. And the medical professionals in that laboratory who looked at it just said, you know, we don't understand what it is we're looking at.
Oh, that's really great. What was the name of the documentary? Can you remember so we can go looking for it? I didn't find that on my way through.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't remember the actual name of it.
Never mind. Well, we'll go. I'm sure we'll be able to find it.
I think it's actually on, I think it was on the Science Channel, but it aired in the UK in September, and it is on the internet. I've downloaded it because I've watched it at least 5 times. It's quite amazing.
That's great. If I don't manage to find it, I'll seek you out for the title of it so I can let people know what it is.
Sure.
And this is another thing that struck me since I talked with you last and been watching this subject develop, is actually there's quite a huge variety of these different critters and different sized skulls. I know you went and did some undercover filming in a museum in Bolivia where there seemed to be a bewildering array of different size and shapes of skulls.
There are. Basically, there are three or maybe four forms. The classic ones that we think could be natural are literally cone heads. They're quite vertical with a large protrusion on the forehead. Then another style is more swept back, like if you see depictions of Akhenaten or the Amarna family. That's another style here. And there's also a style where it's basically a skull with these two hemispheric lobes. So those are the three basic designs, but there are so many variations. That's why we developed the collection and are still collecting skulls in order to have a good system of cross-referencing.
Mm. And it's the two hemisphered ones, of course, that are particularly interesting, isn't it? Because perhaps you'd like to explain the difference between the basic human skull and these more unusual skulls that you've got in the museum.
Well, the great thing is that we also have a normal skull in the case alongside with the others. So that way people can, you know, they have a reference point. We know that that was an Inca farmer who lived about 600 years ago. And so then you can easily compare by looking at that one with the others and see the variation in differences. In some cases, of course, you see that the skull has been flattened in the back, and that's obviously a sign of cranial deformation. But the ones that are almost tubular, conehead style are so complex in their design that's why we think that they're natural, because no primitive technique of binding the skull is going to achieve that incredibly complex design.
Yes, and the human skull's got three plates, hasn't it? It's got a front plate and then a left and a right rear parietal plate, whereas these ones have basically got a front and a rear, so they're fundamentally physiologically different.
Yeah, and that really confounds the physicians. It's especially the conehead-shaped ones that have the most odd characteristics, and the lack of of that suture line between the two parietal plates is very perplexing, because it over time, like an older person will have some fusion happening of the suture, so it'll be partially disappeared, or there will be scar tissue there. But in some cases, there is no suture whatsoever.
Mm. And is it right that there's like a couple of little holes at the back of the skull as well, which isn't normal in a normal Homo sapiens skull?
Exactly. It can occur, but it's very, very rare. And what those holes are appear to be fontanelles, which are ways for nerve and blood flow to reach the back of the skull. And we think that that is an evolutionary process that, especially because of the cone head shape, the blood system, or as in the heart, is quite far away from the top of the skull. And so these two fontanelles would assist in blood flow to the top of the elongated skull.
Right. And, I know that you've shone a flashlight into them, haven't you? And you can see that the actual brain does go right to the top of the skull, the inside of the skull. It's not like the skull's bigger than the brain was or like anything like that.
No, that's absolutely correct. In every single case that I've seen, you can see where the veins, on the top of the brain made an impression into the skull. And there are no gaps. There are no air gaps or fluid gaps or filler. It's all brain matter that was originally inside them.
And whereas we would, with our Homo sapiens, we'd be looking at an average capacity of, say, 1,200 cc, 1.2 litres, you can be looking at 1.5 litres or so with these biggest of these skulls. Is that right?
Yeah, in some cases, 1.6 litres.
Okay, which is, that's 25%, isn't it? That's quite a considerable increase.
It is.
And I think the largest one you said you'd seen last time we spoke was maybe up to 1.8 litres.
The biggest I've recorded is about 1.6, but okay. There are some, unfortunately, which are, again, some of the ones which are most intriguing and are in other museums are not available for measurement. But there is one in particular in the Ica Museum, which is absolutely extraordinary. I've also been in the back room, where they hide their skulls and have been able to see some very strange objects in boxes, you know, locked behind glass that the general public, you know, never get to see.
Mm. Yes, I was wondering whether your specialization was starting to unlock some locked doors for you.
It actually is. We went and met with the director of the Ica Museum, and she opened up another room for me to wander around in. So I'm eventually getting inroads in. We were talking to her because we're planning on doing major DNA testing, and so that requires, you know, governmental approval, which is a complex process, but we're working our way through it.
I know you were actually in the process of DNA or starting to organize some DNA testing with the skulls in your own museum when we last spoke, and also doing some carbon-14 testing on them to try and find out exactly how old they were. Have you managed to make any progress with that?
We have, but one of the problems is that testing of ancient DNA is extraordinarily expensive. It's not like you having your blood, you know, your blood taken or your saliva and find out, you know, what your DNA is. These DNA strands are 2,000 plus years old, so they're broken into tiny fragments, and it's only the most sophisticated computer programs and multi-million-dollar machines that can properly put the segments back together. However, we are working with the Peruvian government now. We have one of the top archaeologists in Peru who will be conducting the test. We have two ancient DNA laboratories in North America that are working with us. We have sufficient funding. So we're in the process of doing the first major study of elongated skulls that's ever been contemplated.
Oh, that's really great. It's especially great to hear that the government's actually working with you. It was something we touched on at the end of our last interview, that we thought that perhaps these things were opening up a little bit, and that there was a little less tendency towards secrecy and a bit more official interest in this.
Well, yeah, the great thing is that the archaeologist we're working with, who is a mature professional, I simply asked him two questions, and he just shook his head. The first question is, do we know where the Paracas came from? And he said, no, we don't know where they came from. There is no clue as to their ancestry prior to Paracas. And then I said, the royalty all have dark red auburn hair. Do we know what that is? And he said, no, that really bothers me. I want that studied. So testing of the hair will also be conducted with another world-class expert in the United States.
Oh, that's great. So, because I gather that DNA is actually easier to gather from hair than it is sometimes from bone, although, of course, you have to make sure it's not been contaminated, don't you, through handling?
Well, it's not just that. It's also bacteria. Bacterial contact over 2,000 years. Hair is actually not the best. It's bone with marrow, which is the finest. And so that is the sampling that we're going to do. The other option is teeth, but the problem is that if you extract a tooth from a skull, it defaces the look. Whereas if you take marrow from underneath, where the spinal column enters the skull, then of course visually you're not going to notice anything's missing.
Okay, yeah. And it's true, isn't it, that although these, I mean, I know they've been found in other parts of South America, but they appear to be there in larger numbers around Paracas. Is that still the case, or are they now being found elsewhere more commonly?
No, actually, it's basically Peru and parts of Bolivia. And so the book that I'm working on now, and I'm getting quite close to finishing, is mapping where these elongated skulls lived, and when they lived, and the cultural relationships between one and the other. And there are at least 20 to 25 major locations in Peru and Bolivia where they were predominant, most commonly about 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 2,000 years ago. So we don't know where they came from. We know when they were, we know roughly when they were around, which was about 2,000 years ago. And I gather that you've now found evidence of pyramids which are around Paracas, which are also contemporary with these skulls. Is that right? We managed to age the pyramids or their remains?
Yes, there are some massive adobe pyramids. Unfortunately, most of them have been either destroyed, literally bulldozed to the ground, or have been damaged, or climate change has altered them. But massive pyramids of several million bricks, which are attributed to the Paracas culture. So, these mysterious people suddenly appear on the coast of Peru. They know how to build huge structures. They created some of the finest textiles ever made on the planet. They understood the concept of the potter's wheel. They were master fishermen and even supposedly whale hunters. And so that's the mystery. And quite frankly, I think some of the archaeologists, not only Peruvians, but anyone studying the Paracas, have been too embarrassed to even approach the elongated skull aspect because it's quite, it's quite a complex.
Yeah, although, it is kind of it is obviously unusual, isn't it, in that you have got something that is physiologically different from your standard Homo sapiens skull. It seems to be fairly widespread but concentrated in identifiable areas, and therefore surely must give you something that's worth looking at.
Well, definitely, and I'm pursuing this simply because I haven't been able to find the answers that I seek from, most academics. And that in general is why I write books. If I can't find, a book on a particular subject, then I just decide to write it myself.
And you do write your books in ebook format, don't you? And they're available from your website, which I'll put the link in for later, but it's called, Hidden Inca Tours is your main website, isn't it? And, the sale of the books does go, and well, proceeds from the sale of the books goes towards funding the furtherance of your investigations.
Yes, exactly. They're both in ebook format and also published in paperback through Amazon, which is great. It's it's a self-publishing system, so I'm not so that an editor can't chop out any of my text or ideas. And yes, it's a way, more importantly to me, it's a way to be able to share the information with anyone on the planet who's interested in these topics.
And presumably you're attracting a fair amount of interest from people. If you say that they're being found kind of, around the world, as it were, presumably you're getting feedback from other people as a result of these books, are you?
Definitely. And also I participate daily on Facebook. So I have more than 20,000 followers who share with their friends. And, I'm being invited more and more to conferences to discuss this, the lost ancient technology aspects that I'm also studying.
Very good. And it's thought, isn't it, that the human skulls that were kind of cradle boarded, that was being done in an attempt to mimic what people are thinking were our ancestors, and it, at least at this stage, it doesn't seem to be unreasonable to think that that the ancestors that they might have been trying to mimic were these guys from Paracas with the elongated skulls.
And more and more research is showing that there were probably several different varieties of Homo or Homo sapiens, not just the, you know, the basic ones that, that we know about. Of course, they found the, you know, the ones called Florensis in Indonesia, which were these 3 foot tall people when, you know, fully mature. That was, you know, a discovery 2 or 3 years ago. And, so there were most likely many other small-ish populations of our relatives, some of whom may have been much more intelligent than us. And the great wrath of actually Homo sapiens sapiens or ourselves is that we're the most destructive species on this planet. We don't simply decide to negotiate. In general, our history has been taking anything over that we want, whether it's people, land, nature, etc. So any of these, there is mounting evidence too that the Paracas population, or at least the royalty, were slaughtered about 2,000 years ago, terminated by the Nazca culture.
Yes, who then basically took over their land and set about doing their own thing in it. I know that Lloyd Pye was particularly big on the subject of other versions of Homo around the place, and indeed thought that maybe several, at least 2 or 3 different races still are living. I mean, he would include Bigfoot and the Russian one, the smaller one, which was, I can't remember what it was called, the Amal.
Oh yeah, and then of course there's the Yeti and
yeah. And I mean, I know it was his proposition that actually Homo sapiens might have surveyed a lot of the planet from the air, but it hasn't actually set foot in a lot of it, so it would be possible for some of these creatures still to be out there and successfully avoiding our predations, perhaps.
Well, that's true, and it's also quite possible that populations such as the Paracas came from somewhere else by sea. They decided to live in Paracas because it was such a bountiful area for food, and they may have been trying to escape from someone, like Homo sapiens. And then eventually the Homo sapiens caught up with them.
Yes, because certainly 2,000 years ago we were pretty widespread, weren't we? That by then the whole of Sumer had exploded into what we might, for a better word, call civilization. There was an enormous amount of stuff going on in the Middle East. And I guess at that stage maybe South America was a safer place to be.
Yeah, it could have been. And also I've been studying the wind and current patterns of the Pacific, and it's not that difficult to get even, say, Egypt or the Middle East to the west coast of South America. It doesn't take GPS or even a compass. All it takes is star and solar navigation, and you can, you know, figure out how to get from A to B.
Yes, and I think that, I mean, one of the things I was looking at last night, because we spoke about the Fuente Magna Bowl, which was found in Peru, with quite clearly with cuneiform writing on it. And when I went looking into that on the internet, somebody has now managed to translate the cuneiform, apparently. And there actually seems to be quite extensive evidence, although it's occasional, it is extensive, of actual contacts between South America, Egypt, and Sumer. So I think it's far safer to assume that there were contacts between these civilizations rather than taking on board the orthodox view as written that there was no contact.
Well, that's very true. And the thing is, it's, you know, it's a racist statement to think that it was, you know, it wasn't until Columbus or it wasn't until the Vikings that people were able to navigate the oceans. I mean, it's, you know, sailing is not rocket science. And, anyone who is a coastal people, if they are, you know, if they're fishermen, you know, fishermen tend to over time become deep sea fishermen, and then deep sea fishermen become navigators. And, you know, it's plausible that you could go from one continent to another and back without, any, you know, major form of technology.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that there was a full-scale model of an ocean-going ship buried near one of the pyramids in Egypt, wasn't there? I think it was made of balsa wood, so it was a model rather than an actual thing, but it was a model of something which would have sailed if it had been built out of proper wood.
Exactly. I know, you know, I know shipwrights, and I know expert mariners who have looked at those designs, and they say that those designs in no way were made for the Nile. Those are open ocean ships, because between something you would build for you know, for a river that travels 3 miles an hour compared to the Mediterranean and then the Atlantic or the Red Sea, would be completely different.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Again, it seems to me to be a matter of orthodoxy, kind of looking at what it's finding and then sort of looking conveniently the other way. And I think you've hit on something fairly major with the orb and hair as well, because it, for a start off, it's not a common thing, is it, in South America? And so when you do come across it, it is a matter of some interest. But I think you also find it on Easter Island, don't you, and in other places in Polynesia as well.
Exactly. You know, auburn red hair of a pure-blooded Native American should not exist, because it's believed that they are of Asiatic origin. And so I've seen so many examples of the auburn hair of the Paracas. That's why we have to test it now, to see if it's actually genetic or if it's the result of aging. And as you did say, the ancient pre-Polynesian people of Easter Island, as well as those of New Zealand, Tahiti, and Hawaii, had auburn red hair.
And their local stories say that that's a signifier of the races that first came there, don't they?
Exactly. They were called, on Easter Island, for example, they were called the Long Ears. And it was later that the Short Ears, or Polynesians, arrived. Because it's also, you know, it's also foolish to think that, for example, New Zealand, which is, you know, quite a large chain of two big islands, would have been uninhabited by humanity until 1,000 years ago. I think that's completely stupid. Somebody would have found it, and in fact they did.
Especially when we know that, officially, Australia's been inhabited for 40 or 50,000 years, hasn't it?
At least.
And the long ears thing's quite interesting as well, isn't it? Because the Inca did a bit of that, and I know the Maya like to wear big ear spools and stuff. That sounds, again, like somebody trying to imitate the look of the ancestors, perhaps.
Exactly. That's a very good point.
So when do you expect, I know it's difficult to say, but when do you expect to start seeing some results from your DNA testing? Is it well advanced, this project?
Well, again, it's when you're involved with governments, you're involved with bureaucracies and chains of command, etc. But we have the finest archaeologist on the job. He's excited because he wants the answers as much as we do. We have the funding, we have the laboratories, we have the film crew. So I am hoping that the sampling can be done this April. And if that is the case, then the testing itself shouldn't take more than a month, but we are waiting for the complete study to be written, submitted, accepted, and then once it's accepted, then we get the go ahead, then the testing will begin.
That's absolutely brilliant. You must be very, very excited by that, because that was a long way away last time we spoke.
Well, yes, and I'm actually quite sick and tired of the whole process. However, one has to be, you know, one has to keep one's nose to the grindstone and just keep pushing forward. And eventually, you know, a door will open by itself, or you pry it open or use dynamite. One of the other ways works.
Well, I guess at least you're attracting the attention of a few professionals now. And to have an establishment archaeologist and a bit of government interest has got to help.
Yes, very much so. And the other key thing is not to simply look at this as archaeology, because the elongated skull phenomenon has mainly been something that was, you know, in the field of archaeology, but we also have to look to it as a medical question. So that's why we're pursuing it in a multi-pronged fashion.
Yeah, and it must by now, I mean, you've been, I can see quite clearly, steadily but surely adding new 6 and 7 minute videos to your Hidden Inca video channel, showing elongated skulls in museums in Bolivia. You even came across some in Tiwanaku, didn't you, recently? Somebody took you to a little cave round the back where they've got a load of skulls. So you must be attracting the attention of the public. In fact, I think I saw you've got something like 48,000 subscribers to your YouTube now.
Yes, and actually more than 16.5 million views, which is great.
Yeah. which is really great. Very difficult to sweep it back under the mat after all of that.
Yeah, it's kind of too late. And the most amazing thing was that the Tiwanaku Museum at Tiwanaku itself in Bolivia had a large display which was shut down 5 years ago. And I thought that was a lost cause. But when I went there in December, all of a sudden they had this new room open and they were doing facial reconstruction of them.
Oh, wow. What do they look like?
They don't look very native, I'll tell you that much.
What about the carbon 14? Because you were quite interested in establishing the age of these things for sure as well.
Yeah, that's something we're going to do as well. That will be done along with the DNA and the hair testing. And in the past, it's been a problem because one carbon 14 test costs about $800. But we do have the funding now to easily cover all of that. So we're not going to be making, you know, calls out to the public to help us finance this anymore. We have a professional team, and funders that have already established quite a jackpot of money for all of this.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Well, hopefully I'll be able to keep track of you, keep an eye on what's going on and have you back on when you've got some sort of results from that. In the meantime, I'm also interested, it's clearly quite a sophisticated culture we're talking about here. I know we haven't had a chance to look into their pyramids, and presumably, as before, nobody's actually doing any actual digging around there. But you said they'd mastered the potter's wheel, so you've clearly found pots that I was unaware of as well. Is that right?
Oh yeah, like some of the finest pottery you would ever find in the Americas. Incredibly thin, beautiful, simple design. And if you spin these bowls, they are round. They're not, you know, these were not hand built or coil built or anything. These were done on a wheel. So where did that technology come from when supposedly nothing like a potter's wheel has been found in the Americas?
No, that's absolutely true. And so where were these pots found? This is news to me. This is.
Well, the Paracas culture, produced very fine pottery, but not a lot of it. So in Senior Juan's museum in Paracas, he has pieces. There are a number of pieces, of course, in the Ica Regional Museum and the National Museum in Lima as well. So there are quite a few examples. And I've been able to identify the difference between the Paracas and the later Nazca. The Nazca pottery is not as sophisticated.
Right. This seems to be a bit of an evolving pattern, doesn't it? That the older stuff is quite often more sophisticated than the newer stuff.
It is.
Not the way orthodoxy likes to list things. It seems to be still trying to assume that we are evolving from the less sophisticated towards the sophisticated, contrary to, I'd say, quite a lot of the evidence.
And that we've been living in caves for the last 200,000 years up until 6,000 years ago. That's being disproven as well.
Mm. I think that's all really quite important sort of progress. And that's really great. I mean, we've already used up most of the 3/4 of an hour I put to one side. But in closing, I'd just like to, when we last spoke, Christopher Dunn, the guy that wrote The Giza Power Plant, which is an amazing book, was due to visit with you in Peru and Bolivia. Did that actually happen? And how did you get on? What did you find?
We had a group of, I think, 30 or 35 with Chris. It was 2 or 3 years ago, and it was a great success. He really enjoyed it. He was able to show us that at Pumapunku, which is part of the Tiwanaku complex, that some of the flat surfaces there are within 0.2 of an inch of being laser perfect. So they were not done by, primitive people with rocks. This was obviously done with very advanced high technology, thousands and thousands of years prior to the Tiwanaku culture.
Mm. And we've still got no idea, presumably, what was going on at Tiwanaku or Pumapunku, because as we discussed last time, it all looks deeply industrial.
It does. It looks completely functional and industrial, and then it was abandoned or destroyed, and after that, the Tiwanaku moved in, discovered the ruins, and then reconfigured them. Without bringing any building materials of their own, then Tiwanaku collapsed, and then the Aymara people moved in, and they've been living there for the last 1,000 years. But clearly, we've gone from incredibly advanced technological achievement to quite primitive afterwards.
And so it's really as much a mystery what was going on there now as it was when we last spoke 4 years ago. There's no sign of anybody getting a license to take a spade to it or anything.
Actually, some samples of the stone are with different laboratories in the United States, and they're being tested right now for, you know, the stone is being tested using cosmogenic testing, which measures the amount of radiation, cosmic radiation, that has reached the surface of the stone or has penetrated the stone. That will give us an indication of how long ago the stone was quarried.
Very good. Well, it still sounds just as exciting over there as it was when we last spoke, but it sounds like there's a lot more going on. So thank you very, very much for coming and sharing that information with us, Brian. It's very kind of you. I do appreciate the time.
Well, absolutely my pleasure, Nick, and feel free to contact me anytime for more.
Very good. Thank you. I will do that. I will keep watching your videos, which I find absolutely fascinating. I'll chase you up to see if we can get the name of that video that was actually on the television so that we can spread that a bit wider. And I'll have some more of your ebooks away, because I do find them very readable, and there's more information in there, in my opinion, than you're going to find anywhere else. So thanks very much for all the work you're doing. And we'll stay in touch on the Skype, sir.
Excellent. My pleasure. Thank you so much, and to your audience.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. All the best. Do keep us informed, and best of luck with the DNA testing and all that. It sounds like it's going really well. It's very exciting stuff. I do feel that, you know, while so many things appear to be falling apart, that we are in some ways making quite a lot of progress in this time.
Exactly. As the conventional things fall apart, the unconventional and the ancient history is coming back like a roaring train.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, thanks for your time. Thanks for all the work you're doing. And perhaps we won't leave it 4 years this time before we have another quick chat.
I hope not.
Brilliant. Thanks then, Brian. I'll put on some music for the folks and just join you quickly online before you go away. And,
okay.
So that was Brian Forster joining us from Peru. HiddenIncaTours.com is his main website, and Hidden Inca Videos is well worth going and having a look at if you've got an evening to spare. There's lots of stuff there. In the meantime, here's Dr. Feelgood, and that's it. I quit. I'll be back with you in 5 or 10 minutes or so. Well, there you go. That was Beer Drinkers and Hell Raisers off Tres Hombres by ZZ Top. I do love that song. Somewhere I've got a really ropey Motorhead cover version of that, which I'll have to try and play at some point. It sounds like it was recorded in a drunken brawl somewhere. Before that, Sheila Nagig and Vlad the Inhaler off Cirque Insomnia. The Kinks, State of Confusion, off the album of the same name. And before that, Dr. Feelgood, that's it, I quit. If only more people would say that, I think we'd be making a lot more progress. Big thanks, really, to Brian Forster for making the time to come and talk to us. It really is great to hear somebody who's working in these areas making so much progress. I know it was something we hoped we'd see last time we chatted with him, but it sounds like things are really going his way, and we'll try and keep in touch with him as things progress. He's got a new website, which apparently is a pretty comprehensive database of all that he's gone. All that he's done, it's called HiddenHumanHistory.com. And as I say, I thoroughly recommend that you go and have a look at some of the videos Brian is making out there, because he is encountering lots of strange stuff. Not just the elongated skulls, but the stonework at Pumapunku and Tiwanaku and places are very, very strange, really uncannily sophisticated stuff. If you've not come across it at all, it's well worth a look.